Hey everybody, how you doing? We're going to be talking about gemstones in this lecture, which is, interesting to a lot of folks. One of the exciting things about geology are the minerals, and many of the minerals are super beautiful and also very rare, which makes them valuable. And generally, we call that class of minerals gemstones, right? Ones that people like to use, whether it's for jewelry or just for collecting. And they can also have a lot of industrial uses. So we're going to get into a couple of them here. I feel like it's a good segue from what we've been talking about in previous lectures. So what we're starting out with an image here of South Africa. Okay, and as you can see in the legend there, let me get my cursor on the screen. There we go. So you see diamond mines is shown here. So we're looking at diamond first. We're going to look at some other gemstones as well, but we're going to start with diamond mines. And there's two that are listed here, okay? Kimberlites and then river or beach placer deposits. This is actually very similar to what we were looking at when we talked about gold, where in gold you had two types of deposits generally. You had the mother lode, right, which is the source area up in the mountains where you actually find the gold in place in the rock. So you can break it out of the rock and collect the ore that way. Or you can let nature pull the gold out of the rock through erosion, where then that gold travels downstream as sediment grains, right? Sand grains, whatnot, and then gets sorted. And so it starts to collect and concentrate in certain places along the stream in a meander bend, for example, or maybe makes it all the way out to the ocean, onto the beach, right? All those different sediment deposits in terms of the ore would be known as placer, right? P-L-A-C-E-R. And diamond mines are no different. Okay, in the case of diamond mines, though, the equivalent of the mother lode or the source area is often going to be these things called kimberlites, which is a type of rock that exists within a certain type of volcanic feature. And we're going to talk about that in another slide here in just a moment. And then the second type are going to be these river or beach placer deposits. So the eroded product of those kimberlites is the rivers moving that sediment downstream. And so in South Africa, we have both of them present. We have, for diamonds, we have the kimberlites in dark circles and then the river and beach placer in an open circle. You can see these are the source areas throughout South Africa, but it also exists up here in Zimbabwe, Botswana, Angola. So in many different countries throughout Africa, you actually get these kimberlites. Okay, these exist throughout the world. We're going to see that in a moment. But then if you look at this, at least in South Africa, check this out. We have the Orange River, which runs down through here, kind of following my cursor, okay? And it comes out into the Atlantic Ocean ultimately. But you can see that there are all these placer deposits that exist along the river, okay? And so these are also diamond mines and then all on the beach. So even once these deposits come out in the ocean, that sediment gets reworked and redistributed along the beach via longshore currents, moving that sediment. In this case, the dominant direction is northward, right? You can kind of see that based on the deposit. So diamond mines exist throughout Africa, really in many countries. South Africa is probably the most notorious. It's had a lot of diamond mining going for a very long time, and there's a storied history there that I would encourage people to get into if you're interested. There's a really fascinating history. We'll actually touch on it just barely in this lecture, but I found reading about that to be especially fascinating. But anyway, okay, we're going to start with diamonds. This is kind of their distribution in South Africa. So let's go ahead and move on to the next. So just more on these sort of different environments of where the ores can be found. So this would be the volcanic pipe shown here on the right. Actually, it's kind of hard to see that with my image here. So let's pop that out just for a second. Okay, so this is the volcanic pipe on the right side. So when we say a volcanic pipe, what are we talking about? Well, it's a volcanic eruption. So when you have a volcanic eruption, you have actually magma, right, moving from the subsurface, from deep in the earth towards the surface. And how does it do that? It does that via one of these pipes. And magma can actually move to the surface in a lot of different ways. It can move through a pipe like this, you know, something that's kind of circular or looks like a cylinder, or you can also move it up via what are called dikes. This is D-I-K-E-S, and these are sort of more linear features where it's like a crack in the subsurface and you have magma moving up along that entire length of a crack, okay? And so that's another way that it comes to the surface. But in this case, we're talking about these volcanic pipes, and these things are sourced from very deep down in the earth. 20% of the world's diamonds originate in South Africa's remarkable array of ancient kimberlite pipes. And that's what we're seeing here. So they erupt, and those diamonds exist kind of scattered throughout this volcanic rock within the pipe. And then later on, miners come and dig these holes so that they can intercept that pipe and start pulling rock out and looking for diamonds in there. Okay. Another place you can get them is an alluvial deposit. So now we're moving from Kimberley, which is what these volcanic features are named after, right? The town of Kimberley. These are kimberlites. This is where they were kind of first described by geologists. That would be the source area. And then you can move downriver along the Orange River here, and you can get alluvial deposits, okay? Or fluvial. I would call these fluvial deposits. It's more typically what these would be known as if you're talking about a river deposit. But ultimately, these diamonds are mixed in with a bunch of sediment, and they're moving along the riverbed, and they're being concentrated and then buried. And so you can go back in there today, and you can find ancient river deposits that have diamonds scattered throughout. So that happens. There's mining there. These would be placer. And then you get all the way to the beach, like I mentioned, from the river's mouth. Diamonds are swept out into the open sea, and then coastal currents, return some of them to the shore, but they ultimately distribute them up and down the shore, right? They can be buried, and we're going to see some of this. This is really fascinating. We can actually go do it. We're going to look at a lot of Google Earth images in this lecture, because we can kind of jump around the world and see how these things are being mined, various gemstones, including diamonds. Okay, so that's kind of the areas of deposition. And just jumping out to that last one, the beach deposits, this is an image. It's from the textbook. In this around gemstones, you're going to be reading the textbook as we usually do. There's going to be a quiz on that, and there's also some videos to watch, some discussion questions, kind of the same old stuff. But there's a lot of interesting information out there on gemstones. We're only going to touch on a little bit, and I'm going to try to jump into some of the more interesting things like what we see in this image. So this is heading out. This is in, I believe it's Namibia, but so we're in the southern part of Africa here. And this is ultimately a diamond mine on the beach. Okay, so they dig out sand from the beach, right? And they're just processing all this sand, ultimately looking for diamonds in the sand. It's actually pretty well concentrated in there, as we'll see in a second. But as they're digging the sand out, right, they actually end up below sea level. And so you end up with water, this is seawater, inundating the area. And so they have this series of pumps here that are constantly pumping seawater back out. You can see all these pipes up here, and the ocean is actually off to the right. And so they're processing all this beach sand, ultimately, looking for diamonds, and they're very successful with that. Let's go ahead and move over to Google Maps just for a moment. Here, I'll bring myself back in. So this is kind of the area that we were just looking at. It's not the exact location of that photograph, but it's going to be very similar. Okay, so this is Alexander Bay. Let's see where we're at. I'm going to zoom out. Okay, so you can see we're in South Africa here on the Atlantic Ocean side, and this is where the Orange River exits into the ocean. Okay, the Orange River, which we've been talking about. So this would be the Orange River Delta in this location here. Okay, and that image we just saw, right, where they're mining beach sands, you can see in Google Earth all of them down here. I mean, this is desert for sure, right? You have this sort of small town right here, this small town of Alexander Bay. I mean, I could zoom in here and you can see, I mean, this is a small little town here that's probably supporting primarily the mining out here, is my guess. But if I kind of come over, you see there's a lot of river islands and things like that in the delta. And so this is pouring sediment out into the ocean here, right? And then it's being redistributed by the wave action. And we call that longshore currents, which is primarily pushing it up here to the northwest. And you can see, if we go along the beach here, see all this kind of carving up of the desert and the beach to the north here. This is mining operations. And what we were looking at there a second ago, you know, you saw water was inundating some of the areas that they were digging. Let's go ahead and zoom in here. Okay, so this is the ocean on this side, right? And this is the part where they're digging out all this sand. You can see they're combing through it. See all these lines in the sand here? I mean, they're doing it very methodically, right? Processing all this sand and trying to find the diamonds in there. And then they're going to have pumps down here that are taking the seawater that's coming in and pumping it back out into the ocean, because they end up actually below sea level. So you can see these diamond mines actually all on the beach here. South Africa, this is the middle of nowhere, right? But there's a lot of money to be made. So there's folks finding diamonds down here. And it just continues up the shoreline for a very long distance. See all these kind of like little inundated areas here. These are places where diamond mining is happening. It just keeps going, just keeps going. Okay, so that's pretty amazing. Again, we're sort of in the, well, what I would say is the middle of nowhere in Southern Africa. I mean, this is just desert out here, right? And then you have all these diamond mines. So that's pretty fascinating. Okay, let's go ahead and jump back to the slide deck, see what else we have here. So how is that mining happening? Well, you know, you can do it on the beach like we just saw, but you can also move offshore and actually dredge underwater, right? And that actually happens as well, because a lot of those sediments, sure, some end up on the beach, but a lot of them are out actually underwater. And so you do have quite a few boats out there that are actually dredging the bottom of the seafloor here. It's relatively shallow water on the continental shelf there, but regardless, they're dredging the seawater. And, you know, this is one way that it happens with this sort of scooper here that comes down, scoops up a bunch of earth. They actually have vacuums even that they'll stick down there and just vacuum up the sediment, because at the surface there, it's relatively unconsolidated, right? It's loose sand and mud, etc. So they can just pull that stuff up into the ship, and then they actually process and filter a lot of it on the ship. You can see there's some waste rock, or gang, if you will, coming off the ship here. But, you know, some of the countries are actually leasing out areas offshore, you know, which they control. They have the right to do this. South Africa does, is, you know, controlling a certain portion of the ocean, right, adjacent to their country here. And they lease out areas here for exploration companies and diamond mining companies ultimately to dredge. So you could buy a lease from the South African government on 7C, for example, and it would be over a certain amount of time, and that would give you the rights to go there with your ship and dredge and try to mine for diamonds. You can see there's different companies here that have active leases at the time that this was created. This is an older image, so I don't know if it's still going to be the case. But it kind of gives you a sense. We're going to be coming back to this same concept when we talk about oil and gas, because this happens in the Gulf of Mexico and all over the world, actually, for oil and gas exploration as well. Governments lease out blocks offshore in the ocean and also onshore over land for exploration, production. In other words, for mining, actually grabbing the ore and bringing it out and then taking it to market. Okay, so some general trends here. We looked at this same graph actually very early in the course. And I'm bringing it back because Gem Diamonds is actually on it. Okay, and we're talking about tons in this case. And just looking at trends over time from 1900 all the way up to 2000. 2000 is kind of just under my picture here, but you can kind of see what's happening in terms of trends. So Gem Diamonds is going to be this dashed line, which you can see here, right? So from 1900 to 1960, wasn't a whole lot happening up to 1980. And then all of a sudden, look at this jump. Amazing. So yeah, diamonds, and I'll just say gemstones oftentimes, have seen a real surge in popularity, right? The production is meeting demand, okay? That's driven by demand. And, you know, diamonds are, there's high demand for jewelry, etc. But I mentioned industrial. Diamonds are very useful because it is literally the hardest mineral out there. It's on the Mohs scale, which we have this scale of hardness that we attribute to minerals. It is a 10. It's at the very top of the scale. So it's the hardest mineral, which you can imagine if you have a very hard material, that's going to be extremely useful for all sorts of things. We're going to look at some of those applications here in just a little bit. Okay, so diamond production has gone up significantly, and that's because there's a lot of demand for it. Okay, so who's producing diamonds? Well, you know, where are they coming from ultimately, right? And this is pretty interesting. So these are the countries that are producing sort of the raw material, okay? Like rough diamonds, in other words. So you mine them, you isolate them, but this is before they've been polished or cut, really, is what mainly happens to them in processing, is they end up being cut in certain ways so that they end up being, you know, playing with light in certain ways to make them brilliant. Well, the countries that are mining and then sending them off for processing and to be cut, etc., Russia, big exporter, DRC, Democratic Republic of Congo, Botswana, Zimbabwe. So all these African countries, check this out. Canada actually has a pretty big role here to play. Australia as well, Angola, another African country. And then these are importers, right? United States, South Africa, interesting. They're actually importing, net importers at this point. So they're doing a lot of diamond processing as well, in other words. China as well, and India, look at this, massive importer, okay? That's because India is known as being a center of gem cutting. Okay, that's one of the very popular industries, or one of the more common places where at least diamonds are going to be cut is going to be in India. So they end up being a big importer of diamonds. Okay, so where are they coming from? So this shows where diamonds are coming from in addition to many other gemstones. So major deposits shows them dispersed unevenly across six continents. You know, there's a lot of geologic reasons for these different both diamonds and gemstones existing, and we're going to be talking about a little bit of that for at least some of them, diamond included. May talk about emerald a little bit as well. But you can see diamonds, they exist all over the place. So actually, diamond will exist up here as well in North America, up in Canada. We're going to look at a spot up there which just isn't shown. South Africa, which we were just looking at a moment ago, but you can see they exist in South America as well. Also down here in Southeast Asia. And then other gemstones, whether you're talking about emeralds, Colombia produces the vast majority, or I should say mines, the vast majority of emeralds in the world. But you can find emeralds elsewhere. In Sri Lanka, we're actually going to look at Sri Lanka a little bit more closely. This small little island off of India, right, actually produces a lot of different gemstones, that are valuable. So we're going to look at that too. Actually, the video that I'm asking you to watch is related to the mining that's going on there. And speaking of Sri Lanka, this is something you're actually going to see in the video as well. You have people that are sifting, right? Different gravels here. You can see gravels on the side, okay? They're trying to get the mud out of the sediment so that they can more clearly look at those grains of sand and gravel to try to identify gemstones. And they do that using these baskets, which they call wati. And ultimately, they're just sort of shaking the grains around in water, and it sort of pulls the mud out and leaves the sediment behind. And so then they can actually take that sediment and look for gemstones within it. But yeah, this is artisanal mining in Sri Lanka. So let's talk a little bit about some interesting facts about diamonds. And this comes from the reading. Okay. Placer deposits produce about 1 carat per ton of ore. Okay, you think about that. 1 carat. Well, what is a carat? Show right here. 1 carat is 0.2 grams. Okay. That's pretty wild, right? I mean, there's ultimately 1 million grams in a metric ton. Okay, so we're talking a very small amount of diamonds is coming out of a ton of ore, but that is economic. 1 carat, and that's coming from placer deposits. Remember, again, that's stream deposits, beach deposits, etc. Kimberlites, on the other hand, which is the source, those are producing 0.3 carats per ton of ore. So that's a smaller amount. Interesting, isn't it? And I ask you the question, why? Why do you think that is? Why is it that placer deposits are more concentrated generally than the source of the diamonds? It's kind of interesting. It might be counterintuitive in some ways. So I'll tell you the reason why. The reason is because streams, right, rivers are sorting the sediment, right? Because as I've mentioned before, different parts of the stream have different amounts of kinetic energy associated with them. Some parts of the stream are flowing really fast, other parts are flowing really slowly. And that's going to sort the sediment according to the sediment's density, the sediment's weight, the sediment's size. Okay, so you're going to end up with diamonds, which are going to have a very specific density, right? Those are going to be sorted out in certain places and concentrated in certain places, while all the gang or the stuff that you don't care about as much is going to be concentrated elsewhere. So the rivers are continuing to sort those diamonds that are coming out of the source area. Okay, so you end up with 1 carat per ton versus 0.3. Canada produced about 10.5 billion carats worth, $2 billion in 2012. A lot of what Canada's producing are gem quality, so going towards both collectors, jewelry, etc. Australia also produced a similar amount, 9 billion carats, but only worth $270 million. What's wrong with Australia's diamonds? Do people not like Australia's diamonds? Well, actually, it's just that they're generally smaller, and they generally have more imperfections and things like that. And so a lot of what Australia produces in terms of diamonds ends up getting sold for industrial uses, okay? So in the United States, 97% of industrial diamonds are synthetic. Very interesting. We can actually create diamonds now. You thought that, oh, once you can create diamonds, all of a sudden diamonds will no longer be rare or valuable. Think again. Actually, natural diamonds are still more valuable than synthetic diamonds, and it does take a lot of work, a lot of energy to create a diamond, as you might imagine. Okay, De Beers, which is the mining company ultimately that came out of South Africa, part of a very interesting history there, held 90% of the diamond market in 1987. However, only 35% of the market in 2015. So that monopoly, really, on the diamond market has been broken, right? Only 35%. They're still a powerful player, right? But other people have come into the marketplace and do not belong to ultimately the syndicate, right? And that's based on diamonds being produced in so many other places now, including Canada, including Australia. So a lot of those mining companies are not part of that syndicate, and so they've reduced the amount of sort of power really that De Beers has on the market. And then last point here, which is just kind of funny, is that diamonds may be made from human ashes. Why is that? Well, diamonds are ultimately carbon. Okay, that is the chemical formula of diamond mineral, is carbon, right? And humans, well, we got a lot of carbon in us, right? We aren't only carbon, but we got a lot of carbon. Some people have actually, since we can make diamonds synthetically now, have taken human remains and made diamonds out of them as like a way to preserve, you know, their loved one, or have a sort of a representation of somebody they cared a lot about, which is kind of interesting. Okay, so here's some interesting images of diamonds. So these would be rough diamonds. So this is what's actually mined, right? If you find these ultimately in the field, whether you're talking about placer deposits or otherwise, these guys are, this is what they might look like. And you can see that not all diamonds are going to be clear, right? You get a lot of diamonds that have imperfections. You have dark diamonds, you have brown diamonds, yellow diamonds, etc. And this is just related to imperfections that exist in the diamonds. Sometimes those imperfections can make them valuable, can be things that people want, but oftentimes they make them less valuable. So, you know, sometimes those would be used for industrial uses, and then they would just keep the ones that are really pristine. Carbonado, okay, this is a product that's also carbon, but it has a sort of a mix of crystal structures here. So it has a lot of porosity, so it's got a lot of space between crystals, and it's also got some graphite mixed in. So graphite and diamond, are not the same mineral, but they have the exact same chemical formula, which is C. They're carbon. Okay, so what's the difference between graphite and diamonds? It's the crystal structure. That's all. It's the crystal structure. So we call them polymorphs. Whenever you have two different minerals that have the same chemical composition but have different crystal structures, we call those polymorphs. And so graphite and diamond are two different minerals, same chemical composition, different crystal structure. And carbonado ends up being a rock that has ultimately diamond in it in addition to graphite. Okay, and sometimes that graphite actually sort of takes the shape in some ways of diamond, and that it looks like an octahedron. We're going to look at that in a moment. It literally has a diamond shape. So a diamond crystal literally has a diamond shape to it, even though, you know, oftentimes if you look at diamond in a ring or something, it doesn't look like a diamond shape, right? So the gem cutter is actually cutting it in ways that are inconsistent with what its natural crystal form is, okay? And the reason they do that is to try to create all these facets so that the light plays in it in different ways and whatnot. But if you look at a natural crystal form, which we're going to in just a moment, you will see that it actually has an octahedral shape. And if that diamond, okay, if it forms and then it starts to revert to a different, starts changing to graphite, it may have sort of relic structures there that look kind of like that octahedra, okay, which is kind of interesting. So, and this will come out actually in the next slide. So let's go ahead and jump down. This graph here shows depth on the y-axis, right? And then on the x-axis, actually, I'm going to get rid of my video again so you can see the whole thing. So depth on the y-axis. On the x-axis, we have temperature. Okay, and we have something here. This curve is called the geothermal gradient, right? And I've mentioned this before. This is ultimately just how temperature changes with depth into the earth. So as you go down into the earth, it gets warmer, right? And so it increases pretty quickly in temperature, and then it kind of starts flattening out here. But as you're getting down to depth, right, look, these are serious depths here. I'm 100 kilometers under the surface, 200 kilometers deep, 300 kilometers deep. And so my temperatures are getting really high. I mean, that's 1,000 degrees C right here at over 100 kilometers depth. Okay, and that makes sense because generally, again, the average geothermal gradient is somewhere around 25 degrees C per kilometer. So, yeah, that ends up sort of coming out to, you know, 1,000 degrees here at over 100 kilometers depth. So, anyway, when you start going down, okay, if you take carbon, it's going to be happy in graphite form, okay, when you're relatively shallow. Okay, so the pressure temperature conditions in this sort of graphite stability field, which is this kind of wide area here, right, the pressure temperature conditions there, those are the conditions under which graphite is stable, okay? So you take that graphite now, and now I bury it even deeper, right? I take my carbon, and I have my carbon even deeper. That starts forming a mineral, okay? And what mineral is it going to form? It's going to form diamond because the pressure and temperature is much higher, okay? So it's ultimately like the crystal structure, right? It's the crystal structure of a diamond is much more comfortable at really high pressures and temperatures, while the crystal structure of graphite is happier, more comfortable at lower temperatures and lower pressures, basically. So if you have a diamond here that, you know, it's going to form at depth, really high pressure, really high temperature. If you have that diamond and it starts coming up towards the surface, which it has to do at some point if we're going to find it, starts coming towards the surface. If it comes to the surface slowly, let's say over, you know, millions of years, okay, and it sort of goes through the graphite stability field really slowly, it's going to have time to slowly change to graphite. Okay, to a different crystal structure that's more stable at those lower pressures and temperatures. Does that make sense? And that's what carbonado can have in it as well. It can have graphite that kind of looks like it's in that diamond form, but it's actually graphite. And that suggests that you had diamonds that were coming to the surface, but they came very slowly, and so they had a chance to start turning into graphite. Okay, we call that metastable. So diamond You know, if you have diamond in a ring, it's not going to change the graphite. You don't have to worry about it. But if you were immortal, okay, and you were going to live for, let's say, 1 million years, that diamond may, in fact, start to change. Okay. So, in other words, it's metastable at the surface. And if you look at geologic timescales, that diamond is going to change into a form it's happier in, which is going to be graphite, basically. So are diamonds forever? Well, as far as a human concerned, yes. But as far as the Earth is concerned, as far as geologists are concerned, no. Diamonds are not forever, especially if they're at the surface. If the diamond is hanging out down here at 200 kilometers depth, sure, it's forever. It's forever as long as it's at that depth, right? But if it comes up to the surface, it's metastable, right? So in other words, it's stable on human timescales, but it wants to change. So I've been talking about crystal structures a lot, and this is an image that shows those two crystal structures. So again, it's the same chemistry, but in the case of graphite, we have the mineral that's shown here, right? And this is literally what exists in your pencil, okay? This is what creates really beautiful illustrations, lets you take notes, etc. And graphite, okay, the reason it does that is because it's so soft. It's almost, it's kind of poetic in a way, right? It's the same element, just in a different crystal form, makes this one a really super soft mineral, while diamond is the hardest mineral that exists. It's the hardest mineral that exists, just in a different crystal form. It's all carbon. It's just in a different crystal form. Just the way those atoms are being arranged makes it very hard. And you can see that this guy is sort of hexagonal, right? Graphite is. While diamond, it's interesting, okay? The way that this is described is cubic, okay? Because each crystal here looks like a little cube, right? But the way those cubes arrange themselves is into a diamond shape. See that? And this is literally a diamond in its natural form. And you can see it kind of has that diamond shape to it, sort of rounded edges. So the gem cutter is going to take this. This is a rough diamond. The gem cutter is going to take this, and they're going to start slicing it down to sort of create those facets. Okay. Again, these are polymorphs, right? Same chemistry, different crystal structure, graphite versus diamond. Super fascinating in my mind. I think that, yeah, there's even just to throw out there, if you take diamond, you take it even deeper, you go to higher pressure, at some point it starts to change as well. It changes into another mineral, to something that's more stable at even higher pressures and temperatures. I'm going to let you go out onto the interwebs and figure out what that mineral is. It's another polymorph. So carbon has these three different polymorphs depending on the pressure and temperature. It's pretty wild. Okay, so we talked about some uses of industrial diamonds, and I really like this image on the right. This is showing, well, see if you can guess what it is before you read the caption there. I don't think I would have guessed just based on the image. I had to read the caption to figure it out. This is a dental drill. Okay, so one thing that we aren't all that excited about doing usually, going to the dentist and having our teeth drilled on, whether it's because we have a cavity or whether it's because you need a root canal or whatever. This is what a dental drill looks like in a microscope, right? Blown up, zoomed in, and all these little pieces of stuff on there, these are little pieces of diamond. So this is a really good use for low-quality diamonds, diamonds that have inclusions, etc. It's still hard, right? It's still got the same hardness, which is the key. But yeah, it's not one you're going to put into a ring. So we put on these dental drills, and this is the tooth. It's just beating it up. And then on the left-hand side here, you have kind of a cool image that shows a close-up of diamond, and it's sort of been colored in an interesting way. But you can see this is the uncut gem, right, with these sort of pock marks and such. So it's got some imperfections there, if you will. But yeah, kind of interesting to look at a diamond close up. Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about how these things form, right? Actually, I'm going to go to the next slide, and then we'll come back to this one. So let's start with this one. This is going into history near Kimberley. South Africa, right? This is where the word kimberlite comes from. And so we're going back into history here. You know, this is a fairly arid area, and you can see this pipe. Okay, so the ore exists in this sort of vertical, this vertical feature, this vertical geologic feature. And you have all these different strings that come down here. I mean, this is insanity. Look at all these different ropes or cables that are coming down from the edge of the pit down into the pit. They start digging out this kimberlite from the surface, okay? And you start creating this pit here. And you take that material, this ore, diamond ore, and you start sifting it, which is what these folks are doing here. They have this kind of board, and they have grains that are on this board. They're going to start shaking that around, and you're ultimately sorting those grains, right? You got to crush it up, then you got to sort it through these sieves, okay? And then you're picking through it by hand to find the grains. And as this pit gets dug out, right, we're pulling all the ore out and gang material out of the pit. And so the pit gets deeper and deeper and deeper over time. And eventually it gets so deep that you can't effectively, especially back in the day, when we're talking in the 1800s, early 1900s, you could not get down into that pit and effectively mine it anymore. Okay, so what would you do? Well, once you dig out the top here, and so this is showing a diamond mine on the right, okay? We have the open hole, so that's what we were just looking at from the top, right? You start by digging from the surface, you get this open hole. And then once that gets too steep, et cetera, you actually have to drill a mine shaft, dig out a mine shaft, and you kind of come at it from the side here, and then you have all these different access areas, and you intercept the kimberlite pipe, which is this very vertical, again, this cylinder. It's a volcanic neck, really. It's where all this magma at some point was moving from deep within the earth to the surface. Okay, so why do diamonds only exist in kimberlites and not in other volcanoes? We got volcanoes in the Cascades nearby. We don't have diamonds there. What's so unique about this particular environment? Well, these volcanoes, kimberlites, are really unique. Okay, the key about a kimberlite is that it's very deeply sourced. It's sourced down in the mantle. And that's important because of, again, where diamonds are stable, right? So in other words, this volcano, this conduit, has to be sourcing magma from like 150 kilometers depth, right? If you look at the stability field here. Okay, so these are super deeply sourced volcanoes. They're bringing up material pretty much from the mantle, which is what's underneath the Earth's crust, right? So the outer layer of the Earth is the crust. You go underneath that, you get into the mantle. That's pretty much where these diamonds are being sourced. They're coming all the way up from the mantle. And again, they have to come up quickly, because if they come up slowly, as I already mentioned, they're going to revert into graphite once they get into this stability field, if they have enough time to do so. So they got to come up quickly. And how are they going to do that? Through a volcanic eruption. So you got to have a deep-seated volcano that brings up material from really deep in the earth to the surface quickly. And there you have your kimberlite pipe. Okay. And so, yeah, once you dig out the surface, you dig these mines. Some of the deepest mines in the world are going to be mines that are in South Africa. These are incredibly deep, and they're ultimately mining deeper parts of this kimberlite pipe through these shafts. Okay, pretty fascinating. Okay, so let's go ahead and move on to another set of gemstones. So here's a couple, right? Here's a couple gemstones. These are all part of the same mineral group. I don't know if anybody recognizes or has even a guess as to what some of these might be. You know, some people might guess that this one down here is ruby. Well, it's not. It's oftentimes confused for ruby. How about this green one here? If you guess emerald, you are correct. Okay, we got emerald here. We got aquamarine, which is this kind of lighter blue, really, really beautiful color. This one is called heliodor. It's kind of an interesting gemstone. And then this one over here is, I believe, morganite. Well, let's see. I think I have these things labeled on the next slide. Yeah, that's right. So these are all part of the beryl group of minerals, which have generally this chemical formula, okay, You have aluminum, silicon, oxygen. Okay, they're different colors though, right? These are all beryl group minerals, but different colors. And why are they? Well, it's because of these things called chromophores. Okay, chromophores are, you can call them different elements, right? That are exist in that mineral that are giving it the color. So just as an example for emeralds here, which there's an image of an emerald down here. Okay, they're green, right? That's caused by chromium and or vanadium. So you have some amount of chromium, vanadium that exists within the crystal structure, giving it that color. Okay, again, these are referred to as chromophores. Aquamarine, blue to greenish blue, the one in the center here. That's because of iron. Morganite, which I mentioned, that's this sort of pinkish one. Manganese exists throughout that. And then heliodore, it's kind of yellow. Manganese, you can have iron, titanium. And then what was this red one down here? That's red beryl, actually. Okay, and that's caused by the element manganese. Okay, so pretty interesting, right? This is pretty much the way that we're getting different gemstones, even though they are within the same mineral group, okay, is by these different elements that may exist. They're substituting in oftentimes. They may exist between molecules as well. So there's a different ways they can be incorporated in. But ultimately, yeah, these things cause different colors. If we look at these through a microscope, okay, we see some interesting patterns here. So I'm looking at ruby now, which we haven't really talked about yet. We have talked about emerald now, but ruby, this is a natural ruby. And you can see there's sort of these, what they're calling wing-shaped fractures. These are the boundaries between different crystals. We can also create ruby synthetically, and it ends up having a very different pattern through the microscope. So you can tell the difference just by looking at the sample through a microscope. You have bands of differing color. You can see also what they call galaxies of trapped gas bubbles, which is pretty cool looking actually in the microscope. So these are little gas bubbles that get trapped in there as it's being created. Emerald, you can see it's pocked with these cavities, as they're calling. You have some little gas bubbles that exist there. That's natural emerald at 100 times magnification. And a synthetic emerald has this stuff that they call flux, okay? And this is how they kind of grow the emeralds. And some of that flux actually ends up being left over, and so that would be a real key observation to be able to tell you what a synthetic emerald looks like. Okay, so let's look at some mining of emeralds, and I mentioned already that Colombia is a massive source, right, of emeralds, and we're going to look at that. So what is this image? Well, we have artisanal mining happening here, so all these really dark rocks here are being washed off of the hillside. They're actually being mined over here by a mining company. And then the gang, or what the mining company thinks is gang, is being deposited ultimately into this river. And look at all the people down there. Tons and tons of people, artisanal miners, if you will, just locals who are just digging through the sediments in the river in hopes that they find an emerald, as you can see here. And here's a picture of them. Digging through. Okay, let's go ahead and click on Google Earth here. I want to see what this looks like. I've got a couple of these things bookmarked. So this is actually in Google Earth, right? And this is Street View, amazingly. Okay. I mean, I just sort of can't believe on a certain level that there was a Google Earth vehicle driving down this road in the middle of the jungle in Colombia. Okay, but this is very similar to what we were just looking at, right? So we're in a river valley here, and you have artisanal miners. They're ultimately just sifting through all this river rock. So these are placer deposits, right? Ultimately, they're placer deposits, and there are people that are mining emeralds in the Colombian jungle here. So pretty fascinating. I think I have another image here, which, yeah, this is also from Street View. But the reason why I pulled this one up, okay, it's just a little further down the road. You can see there's a little bit of infrastructure here for the artisanal miners. But we got an outcrop here, and that's one reason I wanted to pull this one up here. You got an outcrop, and if I zoom in here, See, there's like little layers of rock. So this is really organic rich. That's why it's so dark. So oftentimes if you see a dark rock like this, and it's a sedimentary rock, so it's loose, that just means there's a lot of organic material in it. So it's an organic rich mudstone, really. And you have these little veins of this wider material. That's calcite, okay, that come through here. And oftentimes in these veins coming through this really organic rich mudstone is where you're going to be finding sometimes emeralds forming. Okay, that's how it's occurring here in Colombia, interestingly. Okay, so let's continue on. I just wanted to come back here so we could see where we're at in space. So that was Colombia we were just looking at. But next, I want to go down to Brazil. And I want to focus a little bit on amethyst, which you can see there's a location down here in South America and Brazil where amethyst is being mined. A lot of the amethyst from the world is actually coming from Brazil. So let's take a look at that. This is a really beautiful amethyst crystal. Amethyst is ultimately, it's a form of quartz. It's the most valuable form of quartz. So there's a lot of different gemstones that are basically quartz. Quartz has a lot of different forms, which is pretty cool. And it can have different elements that exist in it to give it different colors, like we're seeing here. So this sort of reddish or pinkish color is coming from iron. Okay, there's traces of iron in this quartz, which is giving it this really beautiful color. And here you can see an example of it. In a pit in Brazil. This is Rio Grande do Sul, and it's just coming out of river sediments in this case. I mean, these are huge crystals, so it's pretty amazing. Okay, but what I want to do here is, well, at some point here, we're going to look at these in Google Maps too, but just some examples of, you know, in one particular mining district, how it's coming out, how it's being mined. So this is ultimately a profile view of the rock, right? And different types of rock are sort of being indicated here by these different patterns here. You have sandstone, basalt, vesicular basalt, a certain type of basalt, which is ultimately a lava rock, right? And then you have what's called the geode level here within the basalt. And so you have this lava rock that exists and some sediments that exist in between, right? That lava rock is deposited over a long period of time. And you might have a lava deposit that comes in, and then at some point it's exposed to the atmosphere, right? And you start getting soil developing on the surface. And so it starts being altered ultimately by weathering, etc. And that process, you can actually create geodes. You know, you can get sedimentary layers in there, but you can also get geodes. That's as the water is moving through the subsurface and through this lava rock, it may be dissolving out spaces within that lava rock. And in addition, there could be spaces that already exist there, cavities. And as that water moves through, what happens? Well, when it gets into the cavities, it starts to precipitate silica. And that silica can form amethyst, right? Silica is ultimately the main ingredient in quartz, right? SiO2, that's quartz, silica dioxide. So a lot of silica in there, and it's precipitating out inside of these cavities, forming things like amethyst, but a whole lot of other quartz-based minerals as well, which we'll look at here in just a moment. Okay, so that was sort of the schematic. This is what it looks like in real life. So this is the quarry, and you can see we got these different layers, including, right, these cavities here. These are places where you could have ultimately minerals being deposited, etc. But this is actually digging holes where they're going into the outcrop and looking for things as well. But so, yeah, if you look down here, mineralized flow of basaltic andesitic composition with a zone of dacitic composition, upper glassy zone of lava flow. So this is from a report. I actually put this in files so people can flip through this if you want. No requirement, but just wanted you to have this. So it's like a geologic report on the occurrence of amethyst in this amethyst mine in Brazil. And it's kind of interesting, right? They're pulling agate out, which is another type of quartz. I mean, oftentimes when you get quartz precipitating in these cavities, you're going to get a lot of different types, including amethyst, including agate sometimes, etc. So yeah, but that's kind of how it's occurring in these layers. You can see they're pulling these geodes out of the rock. So you saw those little those little holes that the miners are digging here so they can get into the rock and sort of find geodes. And then within those sedimentary layers, these mud rock layers, you're finding these circular, these larger circular concretions, right? These are geodes, and they pull those things out, and here's a big kind of pile of them, right? And then you break those things open, and what do you find? Well, you find a bunch of really cool quartz gemstones like this. So if you cut those things open, you polish them, etc., you can get all sorts of different forms of quartz, whether it's agate, chalcedony, amethyst exists inside of here, jasper. All these are different types of quartz, okay? And yeah, many of these things are listed here. Opal, fire opal. So kind of cool. And, you know, a lot of these colors that you see are actually colors that are coming from staining. Okay, they're not actually natural colors that exist when they pull it out. The miners will actually stain them to give them these colors because, you know, the consumer in some cases wants that. Okay, so this gives a little bit of the mining process, at least in this mine in Brazil. So you can see in A here, you got some gem processing. And then in this case, we're polishing the rocks. So they break them up and they polish them with these machines here. Okay, over here in B, they're dyeing a lot of them. So they're putting color into those geodes. And then on display here through light, this is just a massive example of a huge, huge geode, which is pretty ridiculous. But yeah, it's got amethyst, citrine, it's got some calcite, it's got all sorts of minerals mixed in. But just, yeah, a massive geode, pretty amazing. Okay, so actually before we jump on there, I do want to, as promised, take a quick look in Google Maps here. Just an example of one of these mines, okay? So here we are in Brazil. Well, I'll go ahead and zoom out so you can see where we're at. This is where that particular outcrop is that I was just showing. So we're way down here in Brazil. Okay. Zoom back in now. And let's just see where mining's happening. So this is the town. If I come over here, I mean, you're going to see it all over the place. See these mines? So yeah, we're stripping the land of vegetation. These are all open pit. And searching for amethyst, really. Searching for those geodes, right? And then you can crack them open and you can sell them. So yeah, I think if you continued searching around, you'd see more. But yeah, this is what these things look like from the air, okay? Okay, so let's move on to kind of wrap it up at least. And then I have one more thing I'm going to want to show you on Google Earth or the maps. But let's talk about corundum group minerals. Also really beautiful. And I'm not going to say much about these other than to say that kind of like the beryl group, there's a couple different gemstones that are really well known that fall under this group of aluminum oxide. Okay, it has to form in a low silica environment. It is very common to get silica, aluminum, and oxygen in the same rock. Okay, that's a really common combination. But to have aluminum and oxygen without silica, that is really rare. And so you got to be in an environment to form corundum group minerals, which are very hard, by the way. You have to be in a low silica environment. And where do you have less silica? Well, if you go down to the mantle, the material down there is lower in silica, at least, than it is in the crust. Okay, and remember, the crust is the outer layer. You get down below the crust, you find the mantle. So it's oftentimes mantle rock, which peridotite is a type of mantle rock. Altered limestone can also do it, interestingly. So corundum group minerals, what are we talking about? Well, we're talking about rubies, okay? And the red is coming from chromium oftentimes. We're talking about sapphires, right? Both of these are forms of corundum, but just with different trace elements in them that give them their color. Again, chromophores, iron and titanium in the case of sapphires. And this is just sort of an example of the value of a typical, you know, gem quality ruby, 1 carat, 4 to 1,000 to 10,000, a carat of sapphire, maybe 4,500, 7,500. Just for reference, diamond, if you have a quality diamond, it's probably in the $7,500 range, or at least was when I last looked it up. I'm gonna bring my video up just for a second, so I can show you a picture of the textbook, which I've shown a couple times before. One of the texts, right? This guy. Minerals, resources, economics, and the environment. There's a picture on the front of here, which I don't know if you can see very well. Well, it doesn't really matter because we're going to go there. This location is Lac de Gras. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. It's a French name. Lac de Gras. This is in Canada, and it is a diamond mine. Okay? This is a diamond mine. So let's go there and take a look at it. So here we are. Where did we go? Where are we? I'm going to zoom out. Look at how big this area is, Northwest Territories. Again, this is a Mercator projection, which means that as you move northward, you get to higher latitude, everything gets bigger. So it's definitely exaggerated up here, the size, but I'm always sort of blown away just how much space is up here at these really high latitudes here as you get close to the North Pole. But regardless, so we're way down here in Portland, Oregon, right? Now we're going all the way up past Alberta, Canada, up into the Northwest Territories of Canada to Lac de Gras, this particular spot here. And where are we going? Well, actually, I'm going to clear that so we don't have that outline anymore. Check this out. This is the mine that's on the cover. And it's really interesting, actually. There's a couple different spots you can see that are being mined. Okay, and there are these circular spots, right? Open pit mines in the middle of a lake, incredibly. I mean, this is really kind of what we were just looking at, right? These photos. This is the cover of the book. I mean, this is in the winter. Amazing. This would be a pretty wild place to work, right? A diamond mine up in the Northwest Territories. Kind of wild. If you want an interesting job, well, maybe it's not interesting. Not sure. But anyway, so these are kimberlite pipes. Okay, that's what these are. It's very similar. You know, they're ultimately just doing open pit mining to get the top out, and then they're going to do mine shafts to go deeper in. And that's what we're looking at here. You got to take an airplane to get in here. And actually, if you go a little bit north, you'll see there's more of these things. There's quite a few up here, right? Kimberlite pipes. Follow this road over. Oh my gosh, they're popping up. This is actually a different, well, this is the Diavik diamond mine here as well. So I guess that is the same company. But yeah, this one's Ekati. So anyway, a lot of diamond mining going on in Canada, as we already mentioned. And this is what it looks like in satellite view. So I'm going to go ahead and stop there. Again, there is the reading's really good this week. There's a video to watch. There's a discussion to be had, etc. So please make sure that you pay attention to all that. I'll talk to you next time.